Hi, I'm Mary Kay.
And I'm Louise.
And together we are Novel Gazing, the podcast that talks literary fiction. We are recording today's show on the 26th of May. And on today's show, we're discussing current affairs in the literary world and news from the literary fiction world. And we have a really special interview with Sarah Gubbins, the screenwriter of Shirley, which is, I'm really excited. She adapted it. She adapted the screenplay, from the novel by Susan Scarfe Merrill, and the film stars our national treasure, Elizabeth Moss.
Oh, hail.
I know. Oh my God, I love her. And it releases June 5th. So if you're listening to the interview, you have like 1 or 2 days to mull over it, and then you can go see it. I mean, and by go see it, I mean rent it on demand, because that's where we are still living in the world. But it is an awesome watch. Like, I think it's very fascinating. So that'll be the meat of the episode. And then we'll share our current reads at the end. And if you like what you hear, and we hope that you do, please feel free to rate or review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, because that helps other people find us.
It does. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And before we do all of that, we want to hear from one of our sponsors.
Today's episode is brought to you by Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi. If you like pretty things, like I like pretty things, I got something for you. The stunning sequel to the worldwide phenomenon Children of Blood and Bone is now available in a deluxe paperback edition with gorgeous spray-painted and stenciled edges and an exclusive excerpt of the earth-shaking Children of Anguish and Anarchy. Now, this is a series for you if you like action, you like world-building, you like mythology retellings, lore retellings, specifically of a West African variety, has all that and more. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller, a Good Morning America book club pick, and now both Children of Bone and Children of Virtue and Vengeance are available in these deluxe editions. They're pretty, they're gorgeous. The finale to the series is coming June 25th this year, so you can get the pretty editions of the first two books and be ready for the last book. You see what I'm saying? So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Children of Virtue and Vengeance by Tomi Adeyemi for sponsoring this episode.
All right, let's do. Let's open it with news and current affairs. So, what has been on your mind this week, then?
Okay, so I feel like for the past pandemic era, we've had mostly think pieces, which is not a problem or anything like that. I was just, you know, we have news from the world that has been overshadowing other concerns that we have or other, you know, interests that we have. And we can care about a lot of things at the same time. So I tried to find something that was like a thing that happened, you know, like something that's happening. And I came across this really cool event, a virtual event / initiative called hashtag Fright Girl Summer. So it's a play on Hot Girl Summer from last year, but it's Fright Girl Summer. And essentially, V. Castro, the horror author, started this initiative / virtual book festival to help publicize horror books written by women and published during the pandemic, which sucks. So it's basically another way to get the word out about those. And I think it looks really cool, and I'm going to link to it in the show notes. It's just frightgirlsummer.com. And I found it on Twitter. So, and they also are doing like a call for, it's not really a call for submissions, although that is part of it, but it's, I'll just read it. It says, horror publishers and women in horror. Do you have a summer release? I know it's not an easy time to launch a book, but I'd love to feature you on hashtag Fright Girl Summer, and looking for indie publishers to submit their profiles. as a resource for readers and writers. So I thought that was a really cool initiative, and I think it is going to be a really cool series of opportunities for people who have published horror books during the pandemic, like me. So I'm excited to see about it and hopefully to become a part of it as well. So that's the thing that I came up with. I found for my news, my current events, was that virtual book convention was happening.
That sounds so
great. I'm excited about it. It really is nice to see people kind of noticing that everything is the worst, kind of. I mean, it could be a lot worse than it is, but, you know, we can care about more than one thing at the time.
And bringing other people with you, like, for the journey, I think. If you're trying to make things better, it's not making it better just for yourself. It's making it better for your community and the people that you write and your books are shelved on the shelf with. I think that's really cool.
Right, and I think that's really cool, too. And I've even noticed some of our listeners might already know this, but I write the Fright Stuff for Book Riot, and the news section is mostly think pieces. Like, it's some things that are still releasing, but, you know, the current affairs of the world that we live in are definitely overshadowing, as they should, literally everything else.
Yeah.
So, it's just, I was really happy to learn about that convention, but so let's think some. Do you want to talk about?
I was a bit like, well, I get her point about the think pieces, but here's a think piece.
Oh yeah, and I think that again, there's nothing like bad or wrong with them, and we love them. But I just was like, I mean, we mentioned on our last episode that we have been doing them or talking about them a lot. So I was like, let me try to do something a little different. So
I think the balancing of like the practical with the thinky sort of things is a really good way to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, our audience, I'm sure, is full of thinkers because, you know, they're readers and they like literary fiction. So yeah,
we'll go for that. All right.
Okay.
So I was planning for a class that eventually didn't go ahead, but then I thought, well, maybe I'll turn it online in some way. So I was thinking, all right, let's just get the resources together. And I came across a really interesting piece, which was called We Are All Fluxus Artists Now, Natalie Harron, on Making the Most of Mundane Tasks. And I thought, like, this is an interesting one we could sneak into the show. Because Fluxus, so for those of you who don't know, Fluxus was a big sort of 60s, 70s group of poets, artists, writers, composers. And they basically got together and they did stuff, sort of performances, event-making art. They were people who valued the process of making and doing rather than the final produced thing.
Cool.
All right. So this piece talks about how thinking like a Fluxus artist, thinking like a Fluxus writer, can help us deal with current affairs. And it ties into what you're saying about having these practical actions and these doings and the things that you can sort of take and help to control your own destiny in a way.
That's cool. Yeah, I was reading your article and I was like, I hadn't heard of it. And then they mentioned that Yoko Ono was like the most famous member. And I was like, oh, because I'm somewhat familiar with some of her art. And so
that makes sense.
It's like, yeah, it's not necessarily a performance, but it is like the process of it that when you said that, I was like, oh yeah, that makes total sense that is the case. So yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just excited.
No, it's cool. I'm always here for a Yoko Ono interruption, I think. But yeah, so the thing is, what she's saying is Flux has had these kind of instructions that they'd give people and like these diagrams and say, oh, I don't know, let's make one up. Every hour of the day, have a cup of tea and reflect how that feels. That is like the most British version of Fluxus I've ever invented. That's awful. But yeah, that sort of vibe where it's just reflecting on the process of being and existing. So I was thinking, as you pointed out, it is all think pieces at the moment, right? People are trying to wonder what are the stories that are going to be told and the narratives that are going to be shaped from this experience, because it's so definitive for so many of us and it's so big and so dominant in so many ways. what are the stories that we're going to be reading in a year or two, and how will they reflect this moment in our lives?
That's a good question.
Answer it in three words or less.
Oh, no. I can't. I can't do it.
I'll be like, just no.
Do you have a three words or less answer?
I do not, which is why I ask you.
Oh, okay.
I'm so sorry. It's the thing you have to do. If you're not sure, you go, that's a really interesting point. What do you think?
Yes.
And you buy yourself exactly. A couple of moments to kind of go, I need to think of something.
Oh, yeah, I did that all the time when I was teaching.
It's a very useful tip. It's my top tip if you're listening and want to buy yourself a few moments. If you're asked a question, just go, that's a really interesting point.
Yes, and another trick, just while I'm piling on, whenever you make a mistake and they point out a mistake, you have to say, that was a test, and you passed.
And then you just back out of the room slowly while staring
at
them.
Just moonwalked away.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I like this. All right, so as well related to the Fluxus stuff, I came across a really interesting poem, which I've shared with Mary Kay in advance, obviously. And it's about the stories that are in the domestic world that we have and how they've been translated and how they've moved forward from that. So I thought if we could all cope with it, and I totally understand it if you can't, then you're welcome to skip about a minute or so ahead. But if you can cope with a bit of poetry, shall we go for it and have a reading?
I would love that. And this is the one to read aloud, too. It's such a good one.
Yeah. So this
it's pretty cinematic.
This was it was posted by a author on Twitter first. And it's the first lines of emails I've received while quarantining. And it's by a lady called Jessica Salfia. That's Salfia. And here it goes. In these uncertain times as we navigate the new normal, are you willing to share your ideas and solutions? As you know, many people are struggling. I know you're up against it, the digital landscape. We share your concerns. As you know, many people are struggling. We hope this note finds you and your family safe. We've never seen anything like this before. Here are 25 distance learning tips. As you know, many people are struggling. Feeling fiesta today? Happy Taco Tuesday. Calories don't count during a pandemic. Groceries report flour shortages as more people are baking than ever. As you know, many people are struggling. Count your blessings. Share your blessings. Get free curbside pickup or shipped to your house. Chicken, lemon, artichokes. As you know, many people are struggling. How are you inspiring greatness today? We have a cure for your cabin fever. Pandemic dial in town hall tonight. As you know, many people are struggling. Mother's Day looks a little different this year. You're invited to shop all jeans for 50% off. Yes, buy one, get one free. As you know, many people are struggling. Call us to discuss a loan extension without penalty. Act now. Tell Congress charters should not line their pockets during the COVID crisis. Now shipping face masks is recommended by the CDC. As you know, many people are struggling. This is not normal.
Beautiful.
Love it. I just thought when we read it, like, it is so good. And she deserves that poem just sending out to the world and being heard every single place. I thought it was brilliant.
It's so well done that it is both funny and not.
Yeah.
Funny. Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. I loved that.
No, it was fun. I thought, you know, it's a poem that says a lot, I think, about where we're all at and ties into a lot of the things I think that we want to talk about here as well. So yeah, thank you for letting me share it.
Yeah, of course. And now a word from our sponsors. As you all know and have been waiting with bated breath for, this is the interview that we have with Sarah Gubbins, the screenwriter of Shirley, which she adapted from the novel by Susan Scarf Merrill. And just a reminder, This movie releases for video on demand June 5th. So very shortly, and I hope you enjoy. And I was so excited to get to talk to you, or get to hear you rather, about the movie Shirley and adapting it mm-hmm. from the book. And I wanted to say up front that I'm going to do my best to be as quiet as I can during this and let you talk, but I get so excited. So I just, I'm going to do my best for that. But I'm really excited, like I said. And I wanted to just start off by asking if you have a favorite Shirley Jackson novel or story or piece of writing.
Oh, you know, I don't have a favorite.
Okay.
I love Hangs a Man. Okay. I really enjoy rereading We Have Always Lived in This Castle, in the castle. And in terms of short stories, I mean, when I feel like the lottery has to just live alone in the land of the lottery, but I really love this short story of hers called Louisa, Please Come Home. I think it's one of those quintessential Shirley Jackson stories. And she so often writes from the perspective of a kind of flawed female protagonist, mm-hmm. Who's a little, what's a good way to say it? Like, you know, a little too sure of herself, a little inclined to vanity and maybe pettiness, but in the end garners her sympathy. And,
of course.
And I think in that short story kind of really illustrates that.
Yeah. I've noticed that too about a lot of her writings, is that they're in the movie she talks about them being lost girls, and so mm-hmm. many of her protagonists are like, and I love that you said that they were like a little overconfident. Like the first thing that came to my mind was Mary Kat poisoning her.
Oh yeah.
Because they sent her to bed without dinner. But yeah, that's so interesting. And I love also how in the movie she kind of seems like one of those girls, except for she's yeah. grown. So
yeah,
I loved yeah. that. And I was curious as well to know, the project kind of sounds like, based on just some of your other interviews that I listened to, that it kind of started with you. Mm-hmm. So like, what was the genesis of, like, how did it start? How did you start? How did you approach such an amazing, like epic undertaking?
Yeah. I mean, why would you do this?
Cause it's awesome. we love it.
It was actually the brainchild of, one of the other producers, Sue Nagel. Sue and I had a meeting. I had just moved to Los Angeles from Chicago, and I really wanted to work with her on something. And we were reading a couple of other books and just trying to look at, you know, we were looking for something to adapt. And mm-hmm. Part of that discussion was talking about our favorite authors, and Shirley Jackson came up. And then a friend of mine gave me an early manuscript of Susan Merrill's book, Shirley, mm-hmm. and it all just came together after that, because I just loved the idea that what Susan did in that book. She allowed us to kind of walk in to Shirley's life and
yeah.
walk in with all of these kind of preconceived notions of, first of all, you know, what a writer might be like, and
totally.
what a writer like Shirley Jackson might be like.
Right.
And I think then it gave a really, like, it was just a wonderful jumping off point to be able to, you know, get to know a version of Shirley mm-hmm. that has a lot of the qualities that some of her heroines possess, but in really unexpected ways, you know? And I think that having that, and then ultimately to kind of, I think for my end, to be able to kind of fantasize about what it might be like to then form a friendship with somebody like Shirley, and
yeah,
but particularly with Shirley, and be affected by her and affect her, and truly come to love her and feel loved and by her, what that might feel like. So maybe it's a little aspirational, but you know, I mean, you're obviously a novel lover and a writer lover, and you know, I think that it's probably a shared feeling about among folks that are moved by literature, and you know, to be able to like pull back the curtain and actually feel and see and maybe experience for a little while the toll that writing can take in a very unexpected way, mm-hmm. on the writer themselves. You know, we were talking at the top about what are my favorite Shirley's, you know, books, and the idea that we're talking about writing that, you know, she wrote in 1951 in the middle of a pandemic in 2020, and how right. that can have such a resonating effect on us, is a real gift, you know?
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that you describe her as a friend, because she as a character just seems like such a hard win, but like once she's in your corner, there's yeah. no getting rid of her. And I loved that was the, because that's how I pictured someone like any of her protagonists being, you know, like mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. don't like you at all until they love you and they would do yep. anything for you. And that just seems very much like the protagonist that you've portrayed in the film. And I also wanted to say that I was under the impression, like not knowing anything about the film, that it was going to be a biopic or I'm never sure how to pronounce it, biopic yeah. or biopic.
Yeah.
And I'm so biopic, glad yeah. that it was, okay, good.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm so glad that it was, it seemed very true, but not in a way that made it dry at all. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, I know, it was delightful.
You're good.
Yeah, well, you know how it is though when you're
yes,
trying to be
yes.
so honest that it you get all the facts and none of the truth part of it, if that makes sense. But
yeah, yeah.
I wondered as well if you had any concerns with writing or adapting like a quote unquote real person for the screen, because it sounds like although it was adapted mm-hmm. from a novel, you did a lot of outside mm-hmm. research as well.
Which was yeah, yeah, I need to learn about. Yeah. I mean, I think yes, I think it's a tricky wicket, you know, and it is daunting, and it's also you know, frankly, very audacious to and presumptuous of me to try to unearth Shirley Jackson, who probably would much prefer to be left alone, and yet also is somebody I would want to be at a dinner party with.
Totally. Hands down. Absolutely. Yes. I want to sit by her and just listen to what she mutters
yeah. under
her breath, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would really like to eat her pie, because it's been much recorded that she was an amazing baker.
Interesting.
So
what kinds? All of them?
Oh yeah. I think she had a great apple pie, and I mean, you know, so she, in addition to all of these, you know, novels, she also had, like, she was a humorist, and she wrote about, you know, the domestic sphere and raising demons. It's just really, really funny. Mm-hmm. So I think that humorous side too was something that I really got to know through her correspondence with Stanley, which is at the Library of Congress, and just being able to hear her talk, and she's so like the opposite of polite, you know.
Oh,
she's
totally.
She's totally like she's really a cut up, and I kind of, I mean, I would never call her crass, but she's not precious, and just has everybody's number, and is a little misanthropic in some moments. And I did do a lot of research to kind of find that voice, but it it's there, you know. I think she's also just like a really brutally honest person.
Yes.
In many respects. Which
I thought it was so funny. Yeah. I mean, it was like a very macabre sort of, I'm doing it to entertain myself. I don't care if you laugh.
Yes.
Sense of humor, which I really like a lot.
Yeah. I mean, whether or not you laugh is of no matter to me. I'm just trying to amuse myself to get through the boredom.
I'm entertained.
So, yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I was actually going to ask you too about the letters from the Library of Congress. And it's so interesting to me too that, I mean, I know I keep saying that, but it is all just fascinating to me. How writers' personal voices come through in their work or don't, or like their personalities do or not. And I was wondering if you had any specific lines of letters or a mood or like I mean, I know you said about like the baking and the pies, but was there anything that when you were reading those letters really jumped out to you as being like, oh yeah, I can work with that?
A lot of it was, it obviously is a correspondence between Shirley and Stanley and they are so obviously in love with each other, and they obviously, they are also consternated by each other. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say performance because it sounds fake, but they're constantly provoking each other.
Okay.
And I think it's the thing that I loved and I really wanted to carry into the film was this ability that they held each other at all times, you know. And I think there's a part of Shirley that would write and always kind of have that little Stanley on her shoulder, like wanting to, that is both pushing her to do more and also probably making her cringe when she wasn't quite firing on all pistons when she wanted to be, you know.
Right.
So there's like Stanley the critic, but then Stanley the audience that she's seeking to kind of bemuse and impress and marvel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very complicated and but symbiotic in many ways love story between them.
Yeah, that's that. I feel like all of that tension and the fraught nature of like they were so clearly in love. Otherwise, why would they put up with each other? But they needed each other, like just like you said, symbiotic. Mm-hmm. So especially, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but she cares so much about his opinion of her work.
Yeah.
And that's a really high pressure situation for both of them, really. Because like, what if he doesn't like it?
You know? Yes,
but he does, of course, because she's amazing. But or at least in the film. But
she earns it. You know what I'm saying? Like at the beginning, he's saying, you know, oh, sounds a little trite of true crime, but I'll take a look. You know, he's not roused by the idea. He's not like, go forth and conquer that. And yet, on the other hand, I think he does want her to get back to the desk, and he does know that writing is good for her, and it also brings in money, and you know, so it's a complicated kind of as I think most characters are. And there's something very Shakespearean about Stanley. I find him the great you know, he's such a, he's got like Lear qualities, you know. I don't know, he's just so performative in some way, you know, like he holds great space in a room, but he also holds big emotions, you know, and
totally.
Makes his mark every place he goes. And I thought that Michael, in ways I couldn't even describe or understand, just poured his guts into that character, was able to transform.
It truly was such a compelling performance that, like, as soon as he walked on screen, I was like, I hate him and I need him to like me. I totally get where Shirley might have come from in that. But like you were saying, he does feel really Shakespearean because everything is so, like, I mean, I'm not going to say this nearly as well because it's not my work, of course, but it's very pronounced. Like, he does go into, like, the little speech, not even speech, but, like, part of the monologue in the Scottish play at dinner, and then, like, mm-hmm. stabs the bread with his knife. And I just thought that was such, like, an indicative or something indicative of their love. Was like, it's like a little weird, and no one else would necessarily look at it like they were in love, but if you get it, you got it type of thing. So I loved that. I wanted to ask as well, because so much of that, like you were saying, their relationship and a lot of what they're communicating to each other is subtextual. Like, they are saying really profound things as well, but they're also saying a lot by not saying it. And I just wondered mm-hmm. if you had any advice for writers who want to be just like you when they grow up, for how you kind of, your writing process goes with that sort of heavy, dense, it's almost a repartee, right?
I always, you know, it's going to sound very obvious, and maybe even slightly annoying, but the only advice I know to give is to read a lot. Mm-hmm. And that Shirley was such a reader, Stanley was such a reader. And I think that's a way to start filling up your tank and start at least having a relationship with language that can help express all the other stuff that is, you know, inarticulate. So I always think that it's a great thing to constantly be reading widely, and to be reading with a sense of curiosity. And I think that's the thing that is the most consistent habit I have as a writer.
I think that sounds great to me. I love reading, so I'm just gonna keep doing that some more. And I know we're coming up on time, so I just had two small questions left. And I'm not even sure that there's very much dialogue in this scene at all, but there's one part where Shirley tells Rose, I think it's in the same scene, I might have conflated it in my mind, but I'm a witch, didn't they tell you? And then she reads the tarot cards.
There is very little dialogue in that scene.
Yes, but there's so much being said.
Yes. I think that's kind of a quintessential Shirley Jackson maneuver, right? I mean, she's bemused by it and she loves to startle her, but it's also a statement of truth, you know?
Right.
They call me a witch. I might be a witch. I'm going to terrorize you with that notion. Right. I'm not going to help you through this, you know?
Right.
But on the other hand, it comes from the whole action of it is she realizes that the night before she had, it's an offer. It's an apology mm-hmm. to kind of being a little curt and, you know, slightly malicious with Rose the night before. And so it's her form of apology would be to, you know, find a spell or find a kind of a little bit of the occult, have the occult help, mm-hmm. You know, Rose to keep the baby. And I think it's also kind of a quintessential Shirley Jackson moment because she's able to see and really deeply observe people, which mm-hmm. I think is indicative in Shirley's writing. She really sees a fear that Rose has of motherhood. And mm-hmm. In the apology is also is addressing that. So I think that might be what's going on there.
Oh, thank you for saying that. And just my very last short question, because I know that we're coming right up on time, is for people who are not familiar with Shirley mm-hmm. Jackson's work, mm-hmm. where do you think is a good place to begin?
Well, after they read The Lottery, of course, because people will always talk about The Lottery. I love, I think it's a nice length for beginners. I think you should read We Have Always Lived in the Castle and then go right into Hangs a Man.
All right. Thank you all so much for listening to that interview. That was Sarah Gubbins, the screenwriter of Shirley, which again was adapted from the novel by Susan Scarf Merrill, starring Elizabeth Moss, and it releases on June 5th. So I can't wait to know what y'all think about the movie.
And
please do, if you have extreme reactions to it, which I think you will, don't hesitate to get in touch through any social media.
Let us know. My gosh. Yeah. All right. So shall we wind up today with our current reads?
I would love that. What are you reading now?
All right. So I am hitting myself up some Judith Butler. And she is a queer theorist, feminist, academic writer.
Some light reading.
I know. Some gentle bedtime reading.
She's so great, though.
Yeah. I was like, I need to just... I've read her before in many ways. And she's just so fascinating and so interesting. And her work is so pivotal for like the areas that I want to be in and the areas that I want to look at. I thought, do you know what, it's time to get a grip and pay out for an academic book, which is quite the decision to make, because academic books aren't cheap.
No, they're not.
I know. Separate discussion,
why,
as we all cry.
But I guess
it's a weird place. I spent like I bought two and it was a ridiculous amount, and I was thinking it's actually a bargain in the world of academia.
True.
I know. So it pained me, but it's a good book and it is really worthwhile getting. For those of you who don't know, it's basically she argues for the notion of gender being like an improvisation, a performance, an act. And it's just really pivotal stuff. And I so recommend it to you if this is something that you're interested in the notion of identity, figuring out who you are, figuring out how that persona, that performance is created and read by others. It's a really important book.
She has another very famous title as well, right?
Yeah, she's done a lot.
Okay. 'Cause I do know her, but that's not the book that I've read of hers. I'm trying to remember which one it was. But it's okay. And I think it is very admirable of you that you are able to focus on academic theory at this moment in time.
It's like a 5-minute read and then a good sit down and a stare into the abyss for like an
hour.
Of
course. Effort. That's how it works with those kinds of books for sure.
But yeah, so what about yourself? What are you up to?
So I'm reading Mostly Dead Things by
That just sounds
Kristen.
Like the strangest title with the way it you said
is.
That. I'm just reading Mostly Dead Things.
it's by Kristen Arnett, and it takes place in a taxidermy shop in Florida.
Ooh.
And it's the setting alone is real fascinating, especially because it opens with this scene of the father teaching this little girl how to skin an animal that they're going to taxidermy.
Right.
And it's so gross, but it's so clinical as well that it's really fascinating. I'm only about maybe 70 pages in, but it's a novel, and it is one of those where like the thing that comes next logically happens after the thing that happened before it.
Okay.
So it moves along at a pretty nice clip. But it's not by any means like one of those, like it's not really, I'd still say it's literary, but it is not a super dense read, if that makes sense.
That's nice. Like you need that space, don't you, every now and then to just get into something quickly?
Yes. I was about halfway through The Cultural History of Tarot and I was like, I can't do any more research right now. I need to just
find. No, I'm
read
not ready
narrative.
For this.
Right. I'll go back to that. That's the thing too about nonfiction like that is that you can kind of come back to it and not really miss a whole lot of, you know, character or plot points or stuff like that. So
exactly. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it a lot so far. And if y'all are wondering, it has a flamingo on the front. So it's fun, and it's very, the imagery in it is so vivid. Like, I can definitely picture, like, that's Florida for sure.
Nice. Yeah.
But, Louise, where can we find you online?
All right. Yes. Yeah. So, thank you everyone for listening. And you can find me online at didyoeverstoptothink.com. And then I am on Twitter at ChaletFan.
And I am on MaryKMcBrayer.com, but also on Twitter at MKMcBrayer and Instagram at MaryKMcBrayer.
There's so, a good theme going on there with your
sign-up. Yes, there is. Yeah. thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to our sponsors. And we will talk to you again in a couple weeks.
We will do that. All right. Bye-bye.